case 21 in the Book of Serenity. Case 21 is entitled, Yunyan Sweeps the Ground. Introduction. Having shed illusion and enlightenment, having cut off holy and ordinary, although there are not so many things, setting up host and guest and distinguishing noble and mean is a special house. It's not that there is no giving jobs on assessment of ability, but how do you understand siblings with the same breath, adjoining branches? Case. As Yunyan was sweeping the ground, Dao Wu said, too busy. Yunyan said, you should know, there's one who isn't busy. Dao Wu said, if so, there's a second moon. Yunyan held up the broom and said, which moon is this? Verse. Borrowing temporarily, Yunyan comprehends the gateway, realizing the function as it is appropriate. Dao Wu then rests. The snake handler on Elephant Bone Crag, the doings of childhood, seem shameful when you're old. So this is the second day of our sesshin, and I want to thank you all for doing a really wonderful job in the Zendo this morning again. Really deep sitting. This koan is really quite important. Let me read it again. As Yunyan was sweeping the ground, Dao Wu said, too busy. Yunyan said, you should know there is one who isn't busy. When we come to sesshin, we undergo a change of consciousness. And people in this room right now might be at various stages in that change, in that process of change. When people come to sesshin, often on day one, their minds are full of concerns. So a couple people talked to me about problems in their lives that they brought with them to sesshin. And you might find on the first day of sesshin that those problems, especially early on in the sesshin, are quite consuming. It might be the case that something's gone on at work, and when you leave to go to your sesshin, there's a lot of loose ends at work, or maybe there's some conflicts that are unresolved, and you come here, and a lot of the first day is sort of replaying some of those things in your mind, and that's quite typical. Sort of first day Zen practice. But as you move into the second day of a sesshin, you may notice that your consciousness begins to change. Things that seemed very urgent, very pressing and important now may seem rather unimportant, even trivial. It's not necessarily the case, but it's not to say that they are trivial. They may be quite important, but as you begin to move deeper into sesshin, these concerns may be less important, may seem less pressing or urgent, as though you're looking at them from a farther distance or from higher up. If you look at many Japanese paintings, Japanese prints and Japanese scrolls, and Chinese scrolls also, you'll notice that the perspective is very different from Western art. In Western art, there's always a person at the front of the canvas, and then behind the person or people is the background. So if you look at the Mona Lisa, for example, there's the Mona Lisa, and then in the background there's this, all these interesting rock formations and a waterfall. It's very hard to see. That's very Western. When you look at like a Chinese print or a Japanese scroll, you'll see that the perspective is like from up above looking down. And the individual figures are not at the center of the perspective. They're at the bottom of the frame. And the horizon is the center of the perspective, the center of the image, you know. And I think this is very much what happens to people as they begin to go through Sesshin. You know, day one, we're still at the front of our own picture, you know, and everything in the background is background. But on day two, you know, we begin, it's as though our sense of things begins to expand. And where we are not so much at the center of the picture, but many things are in the picture now. And we're sort of we're part of the picture, but not so much at the center. And, you know, a number of people have talked about going outside yesterday and how beautiful things looked in the rain. And listening, the beautiful practice of listening to the rain as it's falling. All of these things, it's like a shift in perspective that happens on day two. I think it's very important, you know, maybe we live too much in the self-centered picture. And Zen on day two begins to take us to this bigger frame, where we're in the picture, but we're part of something bigger. And I think we experience that all the time, you know, at Sesshin. We experience that sense of a bigger frame all the time. There's another dimension to this, though, and it's not just that our frame has gotten a little bigger, but our minds are really operating in a different way. They really start to operate in a different way. And if you've been practicing it for a while, you know this is the case. It's as though you leave one form of consciousness behind and you enter a different form of consciousness. You know, it's definitely the case that when you are in samadhi, your brain, your mind is functioning in a different way than when you're not in samadhi. And, you know, we have been meditating 8 hours a day here. This is our second day. And by now, most people are starting to enter samadhi more or less deeply. And things have a different feel. I think that's obvious. You're definitely thinking is less important. Thoughts are fewer and farther between. And your mind may be in a thoughtless state much of the time, or some of the time. And you may feel different. You know, different people describe samadhi in different ways. You know, some people might feel like their head is full of cotton, for example. People have described samadhi that way. See, some people feel like they've dived into a deep pond and they can feel the water pressure around their bodies. It's not important that your samadhi experience be like somebody else's samadhi experience, but you're definitely processing information in a different way on day two of Sesshin. We think we know who we are. You know, one of the great benefits of Zen practice is to change our perspective on ourselves. You know, we think we know who we are. In fact, it seems to be the most obvious thing in the world, right? But when we come to Sesshin, we begin to realize that, you know, that person we call Kurt or Bill or whatever isn't all there is to us, you know. It's going to be increasingly clear as you go through Sashin that there are dimensions of yourself that are not obvious when you limit yourself to the I or the me. You know, there's a lot of subterranean depth that we don't encounter when we live on the surface like that. You know, in fact, you know, in a certain way, you know, we really are strangers to ourselves. You know, we really are strangers to ourselves. You know, the person we call the self is important. You know, it's important to be a self. It's important to have a self. But, you know, actually, when you look carefully, the self is really in transition all the time. And it's shaped by forces that we don't usually understand very well. And these are all sort of like under-the-surface forces, you know. One person, I don't think he'll object to my telling this story, you know, said that just before he came to Sashin, he had a dream in which he had a nosebleed that wouldn't stop bleeding. If you are a psychotherapist and somebody says, just before I went on a trip, I had a dream, I dreamed my nose was bleeding, you would probably think that was a significant dream. And if you were a shaman in an ancient culture, you would definitely say, "Oh, that's you're getting a message, right?" Another way to put it is that the big mind was speaking to that person, maybe about his fears, right? So, you know, if you're about to come to Sashin and you dream you're going to have a nosebleed that's uncontrollable, obviously you have a lot of fear about Sashin, but you also have a lot of fear about losing control over yourself or your body, or losing control over your life. You know, blood is life. You know, at any rate, it's clear to me that this person's big mind was communicating some deep truth to him, I would say. And this is often how the big mind communicates to us, you know, not just in dreams, but in emotions, in feelings, and other sorts of pre-verbal signals, you know. My teacher, my first teacher, Genki Roshi, used to say that whenever he was at Sashin, at some point in the Sashin, often, he would dream he was a little monk. He had been a monk very early in life because he was an adopted child and was raised in a monastery. And he would say, just before I have the answer to my koan, I see myself as a little monk in the temple. And then I know I'm going to answer my koan. In other words, his big mind was speaking to him in a way that he was receptive to hearing. Yeah? Now, you know, it's not necessary for you to pay attention to your dreams. You know, we don't spend the sashin going over our dreams. And many dreams are just dreams, you know. They're not that important. But it's definitely the case that we have a big mind, that there's this deeper intelligence that speaks to us, and we don't always listen because we've sort of closed the door on the big mind. We close the door on that part of ourself. You know, so, people can close the door on all kinds of things, and it's safe and it's comfortable there, but we definitely make our world smaller. Dreams are not the only way a big mind communicates to us, and maybe not even the primary way. Many years ago, there was a person who came to Sesshin, and he had a lot of anger, I would say. As he was doing, or at least let me say that as he was going through Sesshin, he began to deal with a lot of anger. If you met him on the street, he wasn't an angry person at all. He was actually a very soft-spoken, kindly person. He came to Sesshin, and then a few days into Sesshin, he said, I realize I'm really just very, very mad, he had a few days of sitting with a lot of anger. And then towards the end of the Sesshin, he came in and he was just sobbing, and he was telling me about his dog and how cruel he was to his dog. And he said, when I go home, I promise to be good to my dog from now on. I'm going to give him a big bowl of Alpo dog food and take him for a walk and pet him. This is actually a great achievement, that somebody was able to get in touch with the deeper part of himself. Often we aren't in touch. I think people can be surprised when they encounter inside themselves anger or feelings of abandonment or other kinds of emotions that sort of take them by surprise. A lot of sitting involves being with those emotions. Usually the big mind is working towards some kind of resolution or some kind of opening up. When this person said, I realized that I've been cruel to my dog, that actually was something he hadn't been aware of. And the fact that in the dog, of course, is basically something very vulnerable and something that depends on him. If you're the dog's master, you control the dog's world. If you're not kind to the dog has a hopeless life. And of course, it turns out that this person had suffered a lot of violence in his family home. So in some ways, he was recognizing his own, he himself had been abused too, like the dog. So, anyway, the point is that the mind is, always sending us signals of various kinds, and that we live so much on the surface of ourselves that we don't really know who we are. And we really don't know. There's a koan that was widely used in China that was very simple. It's still used in some Zen places. The monk or the nun just says, who is this? Or even just who? Who am I? Who? 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 When we think about Zen practice, we think about enlightenment. Enlightenment. And indeed, enlightenment is the goal of Zen practice. So, the answer to the koan, who, is Buddha, right? You can say, okay, the Roshi gave me the koan, who am I? I'm sitting there saying, who am I? Well, the teachings all say, I'm Buddha. So if the teacher gives you the koan, who am I, and you go in and you say, I'm Buddha, you've given the right answer, right? But it's not really your answer, because you haven't found a Buddha nature in yourself yet. And to get to Buddha nature in yourself, you have to go down into a part of your mind that maybe most of us close off to some degree. And you have to go through a process of encountering your obstacles or encountering the things that prevent you from realizing your Buddha nature. So, you know, easy to say the answer to the koan, who am I, is Buddha, but the work of Zen, part of the work of Zen practice is being willing to go down into samadhi and learning how to be open to the deeper part of ourselves. You know, and this can be difficult sometimes. Sometimes it's incredibly liberating, or always ultimately liberating, but sometimes it can feel liberating right from the start, and sometimes it can be difficult. You know, when we practice Zen, you know, we might not be ready for psychotherapy, so to speak. And Zen isn't psychotherapy. You know, a psychotherapist leads you down through the depths of your unconscious mind in order to restore, like, normal functioning. So, you know, a psychotherapist has an image of a person in her mind or in his mind who's a fairly healthy, functioning ego. And that's wonderful. Psychotherapy is one of the best things I think humans have ever invented. So definitely psychotherapy is a great gift. But the psychotherapist is really trying to produce somebody who is a functioning self, not too neurotic, not too crippled by the past, and able to be loving and kind and so on. You know, that's wonderful. You know, the Zen idea is a little different, you know. It's a little bit like psychotherapy sometimes, because we really do have to engage with our obstacles and our fears and our attachments, which we have concealed from ourselves. And yet the goal is not just to be a normal, adjusted person, although that is very good. You know, our goal is to produce a bodhisattva, a person who is motivated powerfully by compassion and by loving kindness, right? So a little different goal, a little different view of what's possible. The goal of Zen practice really is enlightenment. But, you know, when we practice, you know, day two of Sesshin, we're beginning to go down into a different part of ourselves. And people develop a kind of, over time, people develop a kind of openness or receptivity to the messages from their unconscious, which often take the form of emotional, of feelings, feeling states, right? So, you know, when I was working with the breath, Genki Roshi gave me the breath, I really didn't allow myself to explore my emotions, you know. You're supposed to be focusing on the breath, and it's supposed to take you to emptiness. When I finished with the breath koan, I went on and did the Mu Koan, and when I finished the Mu Koan, I was sitting in the Dokusan room, and I had just called Mu, and Genki Roshi was laughing. He said, it's taken you a long time, but you finally answered the Mu Koan. And he said, how do you feel? That was the question he asked me. He said, how do you feel? And you know, that was such a strange question. Because I didn't think Zen practice had anything to do with feelings. You know, I thought Zen practice was becoming invulnerable, or becoming like a Buddha. My idea of a Buddha was a being who is sort of like a completely transcendent being, a little bit like God, right? You know, God doesn't worry about anything. Right? He's God. So, you know, when I had passed a mukha on Geki Roshi, said, "How do you feel?" And it was I just thought, huh? Who cares about feelings? I thought this was about enlightenment. And then when I thought about how I felt, I think I said something like, I feel alone, or I feel lonely, something like that. And he started laughing, you know. He wasn't laughing at me, he was laughing with me, I would say. You know, that experience of being lonely changed into something else later on. But definitely for me, the experience of entering deep mushin felt like loneliness. Later, it felt like a great joy, you know. But, you know, this is day two of Zen practice, and we're going down into, you could say, a deeper place in our minds where our consciousness doesn't have the character of thinking and ideas. We're definitely more receptive to the world around us, becoming one with. And as we're working with the koan, we may encounter a range of different reactions that are part of the koan. So, you know, it's not unusual if you give somebody a koan to see them feel sad, or see them feel, you know, I've had koans where people come in and they're, they'll talk about how much they resent their brother or something like that. Those are all part of working with the koan. And I misunderstood Zen when I first got started, because I really did think it was just like a so-called technology of consciousness, right? You know, I thought we will learn how to enter a different state of consciousness. And we will enter that consciousness and all our problems will go away, or all my problems will go away. But I didn't understand that actually, in a certain sense, that's true, but you have to confront and work through your obstacles. It's not just a kind of technology. It's more like an art form, you know? It's more like an art. Practicing Zen is a bit like an art. You know, you have to be open-hearted. You have to be willing to be a little bit off balance. You have to be willing to be a little bit lonely sometimes, feeling lonely. Maybe abandoned a little bit. You know, all of these feelings are there under the surface. We have kept them under the surface because we don't really trust ourselves, or we don't really trust what's under the surface. You know, so we do keep the door closed a lot of the time, and the function of koans is to help us open the door. So let's say you know that you have a problem with anger. You know, you can't just say to yourself, okay, I'm not going to be angry anymore, right? Because anger is sort of like a default position for you. It's where you go when you're off balance, you know? So you know, naturally, if everything's going right, it will be easy for you not to be angry. But as soon as you're off balance, you're going to go back to your default position and you're going to be angry. And then you can apologize and say, oh crap, you know, why do I keep doing this? You know, I try not to be angry, but it's your response to confusion or loss of control. And those moments, of course, don't allow you to be controlled. You know, so if you say, okay, I have this anger, and not everybody has an anger issue, you know, it's definitely the case, but some people do. And if you say, I have this anger, and you say, where does it come from? It's very difficult to see where it comes from, just by like introspecting. You know, it's very difficult to be introspective and see the sources of your own motivation, right? You know, basically, we have concealed those sources from ourselves, you know. And so it's not going to be easy to find them. We've hidden them. You know, so part of Zen practice is using the power of the unconscious mind through koans. So when the teacher gives you a koan, like, if you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. The koan has like a psychoactive property. It's helping you to open up to your big mind and allowing the door between you and your big mind, your unconscious, to open, because you're generally holding it closed. You know, people think that the door is closed, and in doing Zen practice, they have to knock on the door and get it to open. But it's the other way around. You know, really, we're holding the door closed because we're afraid of what's on the other side. And what's on the other side are all these things that happened to us maybe when we were children or even as adults, right? So we're definitely holding that door very, very tightly closed. And the koan sort of opens the door a little bit. So we can look, we can see what's back there. We can look at what's back there and sort of let it out a little bit. And what comes out could be a little shocking sometimes. But often, you know, it's very liberating because, you know, at first what you find might be shocking or difficult. But if you keep going back into mushin, if you keep drawing on the power of your big mind, you will work through to some kind of a resolution. And at the end of that process, you'll be more open, loving, kindly, and self-understanding, you know. So you know, day two of Sesshin is really like the beginning of this whole process. You know, it's possible nothing's happening emotionally right now, and that's fine. You know, you don't have to look for powerful emotions. If they're not there, they're not there. Just keep working with your koan. But if they come up, you know, that's part of the answer to the koan. It's often the case that when we work with koans, you know, we are looking for an answer that squares with what we think the answer should be. You know, and when I was doing koan training, that was definitely the case. I wanted to give the teacher answers that would make him think I was on the right track, that I was getting close to enlightenment. And of course, those were all the wrong answers, you know, to give. I was trying to get my teacher to approve of me. And it was difficult for me to share with the teacher the things that were, problems in my practice. Definitely, if nothing's happening emotionally, you don't have to go looking for it. But something, you may come into the Dokusan room and you may have a strong feeling. Or, you know, something might be happening on the cushion that might be seem trivial to you, but it might be really important. You know, people will come in to Dokusan, and I'll say, "What's happening with the koan?" They'll say, "Nothing." And I think they're expecting maybe a Kensho-type experience, you know, light or a disorientation of something, you know. And I'll say, "Well, you know, nothing's happening. Okay, well, tell me, you know, what's going on the cushion?" And they'll say, "Oh, I don't know, I just find myself thinking about my father, or I find myself thinking about my mother." And it's not, got nothing to do with Zen, you know. But actually, it has a lot to do. You know, the big mind is sending you a signal, and we don't necessarily know how to interpret it. And you don't really have to even interpret it. You just have to be receptive to the signals. And you'll know what it means if you just keep going back into Mushin. So you could say the big mind is a little bit like your own private therapist, you know. I'm sort of like a coach. I'm there to help the big mind help you. If you want to think about my role, a good teacher is like a facilitator. You know, I'm helping to deliver messages from the big mind. I'm sort of mediating between you and your big mind. And the teacher's job is to keep the communication going. You know, so neither, you don't want either party to hang up on the other. You know, so I'm the mediator. But the big mind will definitely definitely solve your problem for you. And you just have to keep trusting in the big mind. So, this process of koan training, as I say, is not just like a technology, right? It's not, I really thought of Zen as like a technology of consciousness, right? There's different kinds of consciousness. I'll learn how to enter different states of consciousness. You know, there's this stage, there's this. And indeed, if you read Buddhist books, sometimes they make it sound like it's, instructions on, for an electronic device. You know, so there's the jhanas, and there's some people say there's six jhanas, there's some people say there's four jhanas, there's the jhanas of form, there's the formless jhanas, bing, 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 bing. Part of Zen tradition is sort of reacting against that and saying, listen, you know what the jhanas are, but how come you can't get there? And the reason you can't get there is because you have a lot of karmic baggage, or we could say in modern terms, psychological baggage, that's keeping you from being truly open and awake. It's definitely the case that Zen and Buddhism in general, not a technology. You know, there are some koans which are really about reality, how we perceive the moment. So, the voice of the raindrops is really what happens to us when we're in deep samadhi and we listen to the voice of the raindrops. We become one with the raindrops. You know, but it's possible that some people aren't able to hear the voice of the raindrops, you know, because they have some kind of karmic baggage. So if you gave a person that koan, you know, they might not come in and say, oh, I'm becoming one with the raindrops. How beautiful to be the raindrops. They might come in and say, you know, I just can't forget, you know, my father's voice when he would yell at me, right? And they might say, you know, I was so afraid of that voice. Just the sound of his voice would send chills up my spine, you know, something like that. See, now that's a karmic obstacle in the way of the experience. See, so the teacher's job is to say, okay, that's the big mind wants you to deal with this. The big mind says it's time to deal with this. So you say, the teacher says, okay, just keep saying, you know, voice of the raindrops, voice of the raindrops. And the person might come in and say, all I hear is that my father yelling at me, you know. But if they keep going, you know, finally, you know, it's like they make peace with their father's voice. That resolves itself into emptiness. And then when that's out of the way, they can suddenly hear the voice of the raindrops. And the teacher says, okay, now you get it. Yeah, that's the so-called answer to your koan. I hope this is making sense, but not too much sense, right? You don't want it to make too much sense. So Zen practice is definitely based on the idea that we can't have awakening without being open-hearted. See, this is not sentimentalism. Zen is not a technology of consciousness. your emotional life is deeper than the life of your thoughts. Your thoughts are the shallowest part of who you are. Your emotional life is much deeper than your thoughts. And the emotions carry much more information than thoughts, as a matter of fact. And so there's definitely a dimension of emotion in Zen practice, because enlightenment is a whole being experience that involves, you know, body, mind, and heart. And all three of them have to be mobilized in order for us to wake up. So, you know, this is day two, and we're beginning to encounter the big mind on the cushion. And sometimes our obstacles present themselves in powerful ways, and we have to trust in the process, right? You know, you can do Zen for 20 years and still not trust the process. But you could be doing Zen for 1 month, and if you trust the process, you won't be disappointed. So please trust your big mind. It's hugely intelligent. And you know, actually, it's we don't know who we are, and we think we're separate from each other. But on a deeper level, you know, big mind is a little bit like this too. I was reading that one of the oldest organisms in the world, living beings, is a stand of aspen trees. Isn't that amazing? And when you look at the stand of aspen trees, of course, all you see are the individual trees. And you know, individual trees are born, and they come up as saplings. They grow to majestic maturity, and then they, basically begin to decay. Woodpeckers peck into their wood and build their nests, and they fall apart. You know, but under the surface, you know, the roots are like 10,000, or I can't remember, they're like 20,000 years old or something wild like that. You know, so actually big mind is a little bit like that, you know. We feel separate. We're like the trees. You know, when you look at life from the standpoint of consciousness, we're like those individual trees. But that's because we don't know who we really are. Under the surface, it's like this big organism, you know, not 40,000 years old, you know, ancient, right, endless, from beyond time, basically, timeless, yes. Under the surface, we're all, you know, all these roots come together. So anyway, this is day two. We're beginning to encounter the master, the teacher. I'm the coach. The master, the teacher, is your big mind. And so now we're going to let the big mind do its work.